From WBUR in Boston, I'm Doug Tribou, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Super Bowl pressure is increasing, or maybe it's diminishing. Ahead on Only a Game, the NFL's Deflategate scandal and the psychology of cheating. Also, as MLB Commissioner Bud Selig steps down, we'll look at his hits and whiffs, what the signing of former Tigers ace Max Scherzer means for the already stacked Washington Nationals rotation, how fat bikes are gaining traction in colder climes, and the surprising connection between sports and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Also ahead, the PGA Senior Circuit celebrates 35 years of keeping older golfers like Hale Irwin in the public eye and on the leaderboards.
There are people that walk away from it and say, you know, I'm happy not doing that anymore. I'm happy to do something else. But that competitive fire is hard to put out. Even if you throw water on it, it still wants to rekindle itself.
Stay tuned. Since Monday morning, the sports world has been obsessed with exactly how much air was or wasn't present in the footballs used by the New England Patriots during their 45-7 AFC Championship rout of the Indianapolis Colts. As theories flew about how exactly the Patriots' footballs came to be underinflated, one question intrigued us. Why would the Patriots cheat during a game they were likely going to win anyway? I'm joined by Maurice Schweitzer, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. His research focuses in part on behavioral decision-making and deception. Professor Schweitzer, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
One member of the Colts has said that the Patriots would have won the AFC Championship game last weekend even if they had used, quote, soap for balls. We don't want to speculate about how those footballs came to be deflated, but why might an athlete or team that has the advantage decide to cheat anyway?
I think there are actually several reasons. Part of it is a fear of losing. That is, if you're expected to win, you actually face even more pressure to make sure you come out on top. A second reason, I think, has to do with culture. That is, in some organizations, the line between cheating and merely being very competitive isn't very clear.
Well, along those lines, the Patriots are known for doing whatever they can to gain an edge. In the divisional playoff, they used a rulebook loophole to create a formation that clearly caught Baltimore by surprise. Can the act of bending the rules, or what some might call gamesmanship, eventually lead to actually breaking the rules?
Yeah, I think so. That is, as we focus on winning, we're less likely to focus on other things. And so the lines that were very clear to us before become less clear. And what's merely competitive versus unethical becomes fuzzier, and people are more likely to cross that line. So in a very competitive situation, people are more likely to cheat.
On Wednesday, former NFL quarterback Matt Leinart tweeted, "Every team tampers with footballs. Ask any QB in the league." In fact, research has found that one of the most powerful motivations for cheating is the belief that everyone's doing it. Do you buy that as an excuse?
Yeah, I think that that's also true. First of all, there's a norm where people justify by saying, look, everyone's doing it, and it becomes part of that culture. The second is the competitive pressure. That is, like the use of steroids, if everybody around you is using steroids, the only way to be competitive is to use steroids too.
We've talked a lot about the rationales and the excuses or the justifications that players or teams might use for cheating. But in the end, cheating is still cheating. There's still just this basic element of right and wrong being ignored.
Well, I think fouls in basketball are a good example. Is it unethical to foul somebody in basketball? Sometimes it's part of the strategy. And I think when people are in a very competitive situation, what they see as the bright line is different from how an observer would see it. Now, having said that, there are clearly some things that are just way over the line, and some people do it anyway.
There have been a lot of pundits in the sports world who have been quick to declare the Patriots guilty in part because they were caught cheating in the past in the Spygate scandal. Now, some say the team's reputation will never recover. Do people typically consider their own legacies as they're making the decision to cheat?
No, typically not. And I think it's very hard to forecast what's going to happen in the long run. I think many people's reputations turn out to be more resilient than we think. And I think that's particularly true for a team where the team has opportunities to do things to change procedures and regain trust. It's not easy, but I do think they can do it.
Maury Schweitzer is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Friend and Foe. Maurice, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
For more on the lighter side of Deflategate, visit onlyagame.org.
What's remarkable is that with every passing year, my love for the game has only grown.
That's Bud Selig speaking at the Professional Baseball Scouts Foundation Awards dinner earlier this month. Selig is stepping down this weekend after 23 years as Major League Baseball commissioner. Here to put his legacy in perspective is ESPN's Tim Kirchen. Tim, what were Selig's best contributions to the game of baseball?
There were a lot of them. Interleague play, the wild card situation, two wild cards actually now, which I think have done really well for the game. But mostly it has been the growth of the revenues in the game. Basically, over the last 20 years or so, the revenues have gone from $1.8 billion to $9 billion. And I think Bud Selig has had an awful lot to do with that.
Selig has certainly had his critics, particularly in the way he handled or maybe failed to handle baseball's steroid problem in the 90s. Do you think he did enough to tackle that issue?
Clearly, he didn't do enough at the time, but neither did the Players Association or the owners or the general managers or the media or anybody else here. Now, granted, it's Bud Selig's sport, and yes, he should have been on top of this, and yes, this will be his one big black mark, but I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt to some degree that proving that and knowing exactly what was going on was not an easy thing to do, but he has, after we found out what the steroid era was about, at least what we know, he's done a very, very good job in getting drug testing, and I think he deserves some credit at least for that.
Here's the outgoing commissioner speaking to the St. Louis Baseball Writers Association last weekend. Let's listen.
After years of the most acrimonious labor relationship possible, baseball now enjoys at least 21 consecutive years of uninterrupted play.
Selig is right, of course. Baseball has enjoyed more labor peace in the past two decades than the other three major sports in the U.S. But he did kill the 1994 World Series after a lengthy strike. Is that something that's just going to be forgotten in his legacy?
No, it will be remembered that he was the commissioner when the World Series was not played. But Bud Selig, after 94, essentially said, look, we're not going to allow this to happen anymore. He deserves at least some credit for that.
Tim, after the 2002 All-Star Game ended in a tie, Selig orchestrated a change, and since 2003, the league that wins the All-Star Game gets home field advantage in the World Series. I've yet to meet anyone who likes that rule. How do you view that move?
Well, I don't really like it either, but if you look at how we determined home field advantage before, it was just alternating years. AL will get it this year, NL will get it next year. They didn't exactly take away a good situation and replace it with a bad one. They just put in one that I thought was unnecessary, and I still do today.
If only there were some way to figure out which team had the better record during the regular season.
Would seem logical to me, but who knows?
What should we expect from incoming Commissioner Rob Manfred?
I think he's going to be very good because behind the scenes, he is a very tough guy. I've been told repeatedly that in punishing steroid guys, PED guys, it was usually Rob Manfred behind the scenes saying, no, 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 that's not enough. We have to go after this guy. Now, on the outside, he's going to appear to be Bud Selig's hand-picked choice, which is exactly what he is. So I don't see any massive changes from the way that Bud Selig did business. I think Rob Manfred will pretty much stay the course.
In your opinion, Tim, how should Bud Selig's tenure be remembered?
Has to be remembered as perhaps the most influential commissioner of all time for the reasons we stated earlier, the growth in revenues, the new stadiums that were built under his watch, the whole interleague play thing, the whole restructuring of the divisions in baseball, the two wild cards. When it comes to all the things that happened under his watch, I think you have to consider him maybe the most influential commissioner of all time.
Tim Kirchen covers baseball for ESPN, and he's our commissioner of baseball here at Only a Game. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thank you, Doug.
On Monday, the Washington Nationals signed former Detroit Tigers pitcher Max Scherzer to a 7-year, $210 million contract. That led the Washington Post's Barry Sverluga to conclude that the Nats are now the favorite to win the 2015 World Series. Barry, the Nationals have made the playoffs 2 out of the last 3 seasons, but were eliminated each time in the first round. How does Scherzer's addition make the team World Series contenders?
Well, Max Scherzer is the 2013 American League Cy Young Award winner. He was the prize of the free agent class this year. The $210 million he received is a record for a right-handed pitcher, clearly one of the best pitchers in the game. And he's added to what was already arguably the best rotation in the game. The Nationals, without Scherzer last year, led all of baseball with a 3.04 ERA in their rotation. So it's a strength added to a strength, and that's the kind of starting pitching that gets you through the regular season. It doesn't guarantee anything in the postseason, but that's the kind of thing that could put you over the top.
You point out that only 3 pitchers have won World Series rings after signing a 9-figure deal, and you've been warning your readers since at least November that $100 million contracts for pitchers have proven to be risky. Can you give us some examples of pitchers who have flamed out after signing for big bucks?
Mike Hampton, who signed a big deal with the Colorado Rockies in 2001, would be a perfect example. That was a terrible place to pitch. He was not worth $100 million there. He had ERAs over 5 and 6 in his 2 years in Colorado, and it was just a disaster. But there's other ways to evaluate it as well. CC Sabathia is one of those pitchers who won a World Series under a 9-figure deal. He won it in 2009 with the Yankees, his first year after signing there as a free agent, and mission accomplished. Well, now Sabathia is on the back end of that deal. He made only 8 starts last year because of knee problems. People don't know if he's ever going to be the same again. So how do you evaluate that? Did it do its part because he won the World Series while he was under that contract, or are they paying too much for him because he's not serviceable anymore?
The Washington Capitals have one of the NHL's great stars in Alex Ovechkin, and they've failed to win a title with him. The city's NFL franchise had a terrible season, not to mention the ongoing nickname controversy. Wizards are having a great year in the NBA, but I'd like you to explain how the Nationals have changed the sports scene in D.C.
Well, it's given another opportunity for heartbreak, in a way. I mean, this is a town that has struggled for sporting success. They haven't had a championship since the Redskins won the Super Bowl after the 1991 season. The Nationals served as kind of a beacon of hope initially because this was a town that didn't have baseball for 33 years. They've been here for 10 seasons now. They are one of the best franchises in baseball. But until this town wins a title, I don't think anybody around here will believe they're capable of it. But I would say that this Scherzer move has created the most off-season buzz since it got here 10 years ago.
Barry Sverluga covers Major League Baseball for the Washington Post. You can link to his story on Max Scherzer's new deal and the sports landscape in Washington at onlyagame.org. Thanks, Barry.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Coming up on Only a Game, is there life after football? A new book examines the challenges facing retired players. But first, Duke head coach Mike Krzyzewski has led the Blue Devils to 4 national championships. He's coached 2 teams to Olympic gold medals, and he's in the Basketball Hall of Fame. But coming into the weekend, there was one milestone he hadn't reached. Coach K is 1 shy of 1,000 wins. So we decided to talk to somebody who's already passed that number, Coach Dorothy Gators of John Marshall Metropolitan High School in Chicago. Dorothy Gators, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You have to start coaching pretty young to reach 1,000 wins. Coach K got his first head coaching job at 28. Tell me the story of how you first started coaching girls basketball at Marshall.
Well, no one else wanted it. I started teaching here. This is my alma mater. So I did my student teaching, and they asked me to come back as a teacher. None of the other females wanted it, and I think the athletic director wanted a female to coach the girls' team. So that's how I got started.
Were you excited about it?
Actually, no. I was intimidated. I didn't know very much about basketball. I knew little or nothing. I would watch basketball. You know, that was my experience there. So I knew nothing about it.
It took a while for Coach K to become the powerhouse coach that he is today. His record in his first 10 seasons at Army and Duke was a winning but uninspiring 158 and 124. How were your first few seasons as a head coach?
Actually, they were very, very good. We started off as a club team, so we were 1-3. And the next year, we went to Interscholastic. And so I was so fortunate. I had some great players, and they knew more about basketball than I did. And so I just let them play.
You have said you had a sleepless night before you notched your 1,000th win. Your team went on to win that game 84-22. Why were you so nervous?
Well, I didn't know anything about the team, so it's not like I hand-picked them like many of the universities do. They'll pick, you know, someone from the pink division. They called me for a game, and it just so happens that was the only time that I could play them. So I knew nothing about them, and no one that I knew could really tell me anything about them. But I think the kids played with a lot of enthusiasm, and a lot of my former kids came back, so it was a lot of fun.
It sort of seems like they must have been enthusiastic. 84 is a lot of points.
Yes. Well, you know, we don't put up those numbers all of the time, but the other team had something to do with that. But I was glad to get the game behind me.
You mentioned that you weren't that excited to get the basketball coaching job at the beginning. What do you love about the game of basketball now, all these years later?
I like working with young people. I like seeing them develop. Definitely like winning. Like to see a nice play develop. So it's just something I enjoy.
Do you have any advice for Coach K as he approaches the big milestone?
Oh, well, that's funny. Give the ball to Jahlil Okafor. He's from our conference, and they'll be fine.
So you're not worried? You think he'll get there?
Oh, most definitely he'll get there. I watch his games frequently. I watch all successful programs. There's always something to learn and admire about special people.
So you're still studying the game?
Always. Always. You can never know too much.
Coach Dorothy Gators passed the 1,000-win milestone in November. Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski hopes to join her soon. Dorothy Gators, thanks a lot.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
How much would you pay to see former NBA players in their 60s play full court 5-on-5? Would you set the DVR to record regularly scheduled football games featuring former NFL players between the ages of 50 and 70? Probably not.
True. I'd hate to see the 100-meter dash. It might take all morning.
That's former University of Colorado football star Hale Irwin. You might know him from his other sports career in professional golf. On January 22, 1980, the PGA's Tournament Policy Board held a vote that created the Senior PGA Tour, a showcase for pro golfers over the age of 50.
But it was a big mystery because what was it going to be?
Irwin didn't know it then, but more than a decade later, that vote would have a huge effect on his career. We'll get back to his story, but this is a good time to introduce one of the key figures in the start of the Senior Tour, Bob Golby.
I always thought it would succeed, but never to the extent that it has.
On the regular tour, Golby won the 1968 Masters.
I served 16 years on the board. And I was on the first committee we ever had when we got started.
That committee got to work on creating the Senior Tour after the success of a 1979 made-for-TV tournament featuring older players called The Legends of Golf.
A couple people would say to us, boy, they can really play good yet. I thought they were all dead. And, you know, and that's how we got thinking maybe we could get something going for the seniors like that.
And in 1980, the Senior PGA Tour made its debut. The first season featured four tournaments.
But the big thing was we had Boris and Bolt and Snead. Without Snead, we wouldn't have got going.
That's Julius Boros, Tommy Bolt, and Sam Snead. Snead's 82 career wins are still the most in PGA Tour history. In 1980, he was 67 years old, 15 years removed from his last win, but he was a giant of the game. And an even bigger name would soon follow.
Fortunately, we got Palmer a year later.
That would be Arnold Palmer, winner of seven major championships. The PGA Tour commissioner at the time was Dean Beeman. He says some younger players on the regular tour were less than thrilled about the Senior Tour's strong start.
It took a couple of years, but once it got some momentum, there was some concern on those players that it might be competition for the regular tour.
The Senior Tour gave the PGA's former stars a chance to get back on top. In 1986, Chichi Rodriguez, who hadn't won a tournament in years on the regular tour, found his touch.
1979, the last win for Chichi Rodriguez, this for a round of 2 under 70.
Well, that's a great victory.
Rodriguez won twice more that year and earned senior PGA Tour Rookie of the Year honors as he was turning 51. For Rodriguez and his contemporaries, there was a lot less money at stake in their heyday. Again, 1968 Masters champ Bob Golby.
You know, the first four tournaments I won $2,000 per first place. So I won $8,000 to win in four tournaments. You know, today the guys they'd throw up with that kind of money. But so you couldn't hang around very long if you weren't one of the superstars.
The senior tour changed that. Today there are about two dozen champions events a year, and purses have grown exponentially. Despite those changes, golf is facing some tough challenges. TV ratings and amateur participation are down. But on Tuesday, the Champions Tour announced a 20-year sponsorship agreement with Charles Schwab. The investment firm already sponsors the Schwab Cup, the tour's points ranking competition. To assess the deal, I spoke with Whitney Wagner. Are you a golfer?
I technically play golf.
Wagner is the program manager of the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon, and she spent nearly 8 years selling sponsorships for another pretty well-known sports organization, the NFL. Does the length of the deal surprise you with the 20-year partnership?
Definitely, yes. You know, we see shorter-term deals, 4 or 5 years really is what the industry is seeing right now in terms of traditional sponsorship. So for Charles Schwab, frankly, to have as much confidence in this partnership as this shows, I think is really noteworthy.
And Wagner says there are financial risks in long-term sponsorships, but this deal is based on a unique opportunity.
For customers of Charles Schwab to really see themselves in the guys that are out there on the course, right? I mean, that's one of the things that golf as a property can provide, and it's a spot-on demographic match for your product. It's really perfect.
Fans might also be able to relate to struggling pros who found a second chance after 50. Michael Allen had exactly 0 wins in more than 2 decades on the regular tour, but since 2009, he's recorded 7 on the Champions Tour. For him, the first was the sweetest.
Oh, gosh, that kind of... It was incredible, you know, and then to finally see guys actually congratulate me on something like that, and it's really cool. It was wonderful, and you know, then you kind of get used to a little bit, and you know, it just gets to be more and more fun.
Hale Irwin, who is now 70, has had plenty of fun since joining the Champions Tour in the mid-1990s and racking up a record 45 wins. In 3 decades on the regular tour, Irwin earned 20 career victories and almost $6 million. Not too shabby, but on the Champions Tour, he's taken home nearly $27 million in purses. Although today's younger players make more money than ever, Irwin's optimistic stars will still join the senior circuit.
That competitive fire is hard to put out. Even if you throw water on it, it still wants to rekindle itself. The mental part of golf is the biggest part of the game, and that's the same way when you're away from it. Do you love it enough? Do you enjoy it enough? Does it drive you enough to say, I still want to play?
As the Champions Tour turns 35, the PGA is counting on that drive and hoping the tour and its senior players will only get better with age. The NFL ravenously devours the men who play its game in order to create the players that make the league successful. You're either inside the bubble or you're out. That idea is at the core of Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, a new book by Marquette University sociology professors James Holstein and Richard Jones and former NFL linebacker George Kuntz Jr. From the studios of Milwaukee Public Radio, George Kuntz and James Holstein join me now. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
George, I'd like to start inside the bubble. You played for 9 seasons in the NFL from 1992 to 2000, won a Super Bowl with the Green Bay Packers. Describe what it was like to live in that bubble.
I would say that I entered into the bubble when I was about 9 years old. My mom got me involved with youth football and Pop Warner football down in eastern North Carolina. Each transition, it gets more intense. I loved it while I was inside the bubble. But when the bubble kind of burst, kind of felt like I was isolated. I was very, very dependent upon the bubble.
James, in the book, you write that NFL teams come, quote, perilously close to babysitting players. How does that kind of treatment affect those players?
After years and years of having things done for you, it creates a sort of dependency. this dependency kind of deprives players of a chance to grow up into the sorts of adults that their age peers might be. And so guys are a little bit ill-equipped to be set free out into the world and to manage for themselves.
George, to me, one of the most striking things in the book is the revelation that you played your final game in the 2000 season, but didn't really realize it was your last until 2.5 seasons later. How did that happen?
I signed a one-year deal with the Seattle Seahawks in 2000. I ended up starting 16 out of 16 ball games. I was second on the team in tackles. And I was just waiting by the phone for the next 2 years, basically, looking for another opportunity. But that opportunity never came. My wife at the time said, George, it's all over. You have to move on. And it was tough being kind of hung out to dry and not knowing one way or the other if my career was over with.
And even 2.5 years later, it was tough to hear your wife say that, right?
Most definitely. It was tough.
James, the big salaries players can make are part of many conversations about pro sports. In the chapter titled All That Dough, Where Did It Go? You quote a coach who says NFL players feel, quote, obligated to living a certain lifestyle. But isn't there an element of personal responsibility involved, too?
Absolutely. There's a lot of money involved, but players probably don't make as much as most people think. Everybody's making a minimum of, say, $400,000 now, and so are not, as most 24, 25, 26-year-olds, are not looking to put their money into tax-free municipal funds. Of course, individuals are responsible for this themselves, but they lose perspective on what the money means and what they're doing with it.
George, you went back to school, earned a master's, and then your PhD, and your post-NFL career has included positions with the Packers, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and your current job as Vice President of Advancement at Marion University. For you, what was the key to finding life after football?
Well, I just wanted to find my passion and my purpose. At one point in my life, I thought running around on the football field was my purpose. That's the furthest thing from the truth. I'm all about trying to give individuals opportunity. 50 to 55% of our students are from low-income families or they're first in their families to go to college. So basically what I'm doing is trying to help close that gap and give them the necessary resources to get that college degree so they can live out the American dream. Because if it wasn't for a football scholarship, I would have never had a chance to go to college.
James, near the end of the book, you make some recommendations about what the NFL could do to improve the life of players who've left the league. Tell us a little bit about some of your top recommendations.
Well, many of the things that we would suggest are already at least partially in place. The league itself and the Players Association, the union, if you go to their websites, you can see an extensive list of services and different programs that are available to help players move into new careers, to help them with their health problems, to help them with their money problems. A second thing, the NFL, with its non-guaranteed contracts and with its salary cap, does not pay nearly as well as the other major sports leagues. Average player in the NFL makes maybe $2 million a year now. It's over $5 million in Major League Baseball. The reason is primarily this non-guaranteed contract, which leaves players like George, who signed good contracts in good faith, but when the team wanted to move on, they moved on without him.
But they're still making more money than the average person. It seems like there are more opportunities for former players to capitalize if they've built names for themselves. Is this just a problem with non-stars?
Yeah, that's a problem for most of the players because most of the players don't have the names of John Elway and Joe Montana. George was more purposeful than most. He went back to school and he sought out a job. Most NFL players do have a continuing stream of income. They make the income of an NFL retired NFL player is twice that of the median income of their age peers outside of football. They're not making the kind of money they made as players, but they're doing pretty well, and I think we lose sight of that too.
Because of the dramatic stories that we hear, like a Warren Sapp,
exactly,
who's lost literally tens of millions of dollars.
Exactly.
Exactly.
If for every Warren Sapp, there are probably more than a half dozen other guys who have saved something, who get up in the morning and manage their investments or manage their businesses or go to work.
George, I'd like to close by asking you if you still miss the NFL and if you would do it all again.
Yes, I do. I've had over 11 concussions, 7 surgeries. I'm having issues right now with my back and with memory loss. But if I can do it all over again, I will strap it on and go back to running around trying to hit people because I really had a lot of fun.
George Kuntz Jr. and James Holstein co-authored the book, Is There Life After Football?, along with Richard Jones. You can read an excerpt at onlyagame.org. George, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And James, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Only a Game, why does the story of Martin Luther King's most famous speech belong on a sports show? We'll explain. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Doug.
In the biggest sports story of the week, it's the NFL Pro Bowl weekend.
Oh,
hang on. I think somebody put
please,
the wrong page on
top. Please, can we talk about the Pro Bowl? Can we please talk about the Pro Bowl? I think Team Dion's got a real shot this year.
So about Deflategate, is it all a lot of hot air, or has the Patriots' legacy been forever tarnished?
I don't know. I don't care. It's the equivalent of an emery board in the pitcher's glove, a corked bat, a hockey stick that's bent a few millimeters too far. You know, the idea that this has become some sort of national scandal indicates only that we've become a nation of infantilized yahoos. Now, there's one slight caveat to that. Both Bill Belichick and Tom Brady left themselves no wiggle room in their denials of having anything to do with whatever this is supposed to be about. If that turns out to be wrong, their credibility shot. But on its merits, this thing should have been laughed off in an hour and a half.
There will be no concerns about tampered footballs during next Sunday's Super Bowl, Charlie. The Chicago Bears equipment manager will be in charge. Do you think that will do anything to assure the masses?
Yeah, because that means both teams will lose. No, that's not true. One is compelled at this point to ask the question, if this thing is a way to keep things on an even playing field, why the hell doesn't the NFL do this for every game?
Seattle running back Marshawn Lynch would rather pay fines than speak to the media. Now he finally finds a way to express himself, and he gets another fine. What gives?
Well, you can't be grabbing your groinal area in a demonstration of your superiority in the NFL, which, by the way, can't find its way to talk to Tom Brady about this whole football thing that's been exploding all around them. But they, by God, can fine Marshawn Lynch $20,000 for doing that and make sure he doesn't wear gold cleats.
In less controversial Super Bowl news, this year's game has inspired a super bet. Please tell us about the stakes agreed upon by Captain America and his fellow Marvel Comics character, Star-Lord.
First of all, this is a great story because it finally explains to me that Chris Pratt and Chris Evans are not the same guy, which I went a long time believing. Apparently, Evans is a Pats fan and Pratt is a Seahawks fan. The loser of the bet has to visit a children's hospital in costume in the winner of the bet's area. That leads me to really want to tie, so they both have to do this.
Right, exactly. Charlie, we had vowed we would not speak again this season of the lowly New York Knicks, but on Monday, they finally broke their 16-game losing streak, so I guess that deserves a tip of the Only a Game cap.
And they won the next night, too. They won two games in a row. They're still awful, and there's no reason to talk about them after this. And certainly we're not going to make an issue out of every time they win a game.
When billionaire Steve Ballmer bought the L.A. Clippers for $2 billion, we knew that the value of all NBA teams would rise as a result. But now Forbes says those values have increased by an average of 72%. I'm not an investment expert, but doesn't that seem like a pretty good return to you?
It's a really good investment if you happen to have a couple of billion dollars to invest in the first place. The Lakers went up 93% in value despite having a terrible year and probably seeing the end of Kobe Bryant. And the Golden State Warriors went up 73% value. And, of course, the Brooklyn Nets went up 92% valuable, and they're for sale. So good luck if you happen to have a couple of billions sitting around the couch.
The NCAA voted 79-1 to increase the value of student-athlete scholarships to reflect the full cost of attendance. Do you think the lone dissenter missed all the news about the class action lawsuits currently making their way through the courts?
Oh, no. This is another sandbag against the rising tide. This cost of attendance thing was something that they talked about as a possibility while the O'Bannon trial was going on, and even more enthusiastically after they lost the ruling there. Yeah, they're stacking the sandbags as high as they can, but the wall's still going to come down sooner or later.
Ace Max Scherzer's $200 million contract with the Washington Nationals made big news this week, but I'd like you to consider 33-year-old pitcher Dontrell Willis out of the league since 2011. He signed a minor league deal with the Milwaukee Brewers. What brought Mr. Willis back to the game?
He just likes baseball, and he said he likes being on the field. He doesn't play golf very well. He doesn't own an Xbox, and he has four daughters. I don't know where the daughters figure in with the golf and the Xbox, but this will be a good story, and it's a no-lose move for the Brewers.
Las Vegas is still the reported first choice for NHL expansion, and this week an anonymous owner let slip how much he thinks the league will charge for that honor. Even for Vegas, it seems like a substantial sum.
Yes, it's going to come in somewhere between $450 and $500 million, and that would suggest $475 million, which is an incredible fee for a franchise in what is essentially the fourth North American major league.
Jeff Gordon says 2015 will be his last season as a full-time driver. Mr. NASCAR, would you like to comment on Mr. Gordon's farewell lap?
Oh, it's going to be fascinating because he's always been a lightning rod among the diehard fan base, especially when Dale Earnhardt was still alive, because Earnhardt was always posed as the anti-Jeff Gordon, who was a wealthy kid. He wasn't from the South. His father got him started. He was handsome. He got a lot of attention. The aggrieved blue-collar base of NASCAR fans never really liked him, but I guarantee you he will go out flooded with warm feelings from the NASCAR crowd.
And finally, Charlie, a seagull was struck by a cricket ball during a match in Melbourne. As 30,000 fans looked on, one of the players carefully carried the motionless bird over the boundary line. Would you like to pick up the story from there?
Yes, the bird came back to life and flew away, and everybody in the stadium went, "Ah!" This proves only one thing.
What's that?
That cricket is so boring, it can wake the dead.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Doug.
The nation celebrated Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday.
We'll be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
King famously improvised those words to conclude his speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963. What does that have to do with sports? In a story for Sports Illustrated, Seth Davis explains the connection. Seth, how did then-Villanova volunteer assistant basketball coach George Raveling end up with Martin Luther King Jr.'s own copy of the "I Have a Dream" speech?
History and happenstance. What happened was Raveling at the time was working actually full-time for Converse and volunteering as an assistant coach at Villanova, where he had recently finished up his playing career. He had a very good friend, fellow African-American, and they were at his dad's house two nights before the march. The dad said, "Are you guys going to the march?" They said, "No." And then he said, "Well, I think you guys ought to be there, and take my car, and here's a couple of bucks to get you through the trip." They drove down the night before, and they were just wandering around the mall, and one of the organizers of the march saw these big, two strong young guys and said, "Can you help us out with security?" So they said, sure. They showed up the next morning, and they were just positioned on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. So Raveling has always been a collector, and when King's speech was done, Raveling just walked right up to him and said, "Dr. King, can I have those?" And King, you know, flummoxed by the moment, I guess, just kind of handed him over, and that was that.
We'll get back to where the papers ended up in a minute, but tell us a little bit more about Raveling's pioneering role in college basketball.
Well, in a lot of ways, he fell into it. He had grown up in the Washington, D.C. area. His father died when he was 7 years old, and then shortly thereafter, his mother became seriously mentally ill and was hospitalized, really, for most of the balance of her life. So he was kind of orphaned through charitable organizations, was able to go to a boarding school in Pennsylvania, and was invited to play for the basketball team. Hadn't really played much, but was a big, strong guy, rebounded a lot, and ended up getting offered scholarships and ended up at Villanova University. So, you know, from there, he had such a charisma about him that he had the chance to recruit African-American players, not only to Villanova, but then to Maryland, where he got hired as a full-time assistant to Lefty Driesell.
In 1972, Raveling left Maryland to take the head coaching job at Washington State, making him the Pac-8's first black coach. But it wasn't until he took the job at USC in 1986 that he began speaking out about social issues. What changed for him?
I just think time. For many years, he was reluctant to really insert himself into, you know, speaking up about issues other than pure basketball. He became an elder statesman and was very active in the National Association of Basketball Coaches. He was an assistant coach on the U.S. Olympic team, where there was that intersection of race, education, and athletics. He very much inserted himself into that conversation.
So let's get back to the pages that Raveling received from Martin Luther King. I love the fact that for nearly 20 years, Raveling kept them in another collector's item, an autographed Harry Truman biography stored in his basement. Eventually, a reporter learned about the papers and then had the museum treated and framed for Raveling. There have to be people who would pay a lot of money to own them.
Some collector called him about a year and a half ago and offered him $3 million for that document, and he won't sell it. You know, he says he's the caretaker. It belongs to the nation. It belongs to the public. It belongs to his fellow African-American brothers and sisters, and he's hoping at some point that the speech will be on display, but he has, as I mentioned in the story, put a clause into his will, because George is 77 now, that if he passes, then custody of the speech will go to his son, Mark. The only condition is that Mark may never sell it.
George Raveling stopped coaching in 1994, his career record 337 and 292. He's now 77 years old and works for Nike as their director of international basketball. What is his legacy?
Well, his legacy is in the relationships and the mentoring and the information that he's passed on to all kinds of coaches, young, old, black, white, everything in between. You know, there was a time when he was at USC, he used to mail out a big batch of newspaper clips, and he'd have like a little cover on it, you know, I don't think it was called Reading with Raveling or something like that. And he would send them out to hundreds of coaches and young people, and they would have nothing to do with sports, nothing to do with basketball. It might be on politics. It might be on history. It might be on healthcare. It might be on race. It could be on anything. And he really, you know, considered himself a great portal of information.
Seth Davis is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and you can link to his story, Pioneering Coach George Raveling's Surprising Connection to MLK, at our website, onlyagame.org. Seth, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. I love your show, and it's a great honor to be on here and talk about the story.
Back in the late 70s, the mountain bike was created by modifying a Schwinn bicycle with balloon tires. In the early 90s, a cycling enthusiast in Alaska welded rims together to hold even fatter tires so his bike could ride on snow. In recent years, the so-called fat bikes have taken off in colder climbs. Only a Game's John Kalish has our story.
On a snowy December afternoon, I drop by the Onion River Sports Shop in Montpelier, Vermont's capital. Kip Roberts manages the store. He says that 2 years ago, fat bikes went from an oddity to a hot item.
It exploded, and we couldn't get our hands on them quick enough. And that growth happened all across the country. Almost everyone that's a major bicycle company has a fat bike now, and some of them have multiple models.
Roberts took me to a nature preserve in Montpelier. He gave me some fat biking advice.
If you have too much weight over your handlebars and over your front wheel, especially if you grab a handful of front brake around a corner, you're going to slide out just due to the slippery nature of the snow or ice that you're on.
Which is exactly what happened. You can't ride very easily with just one hand on the handlebars, which is what I had to do while pointing a shotgun microphone down at the fat bike's front tire crunching over the snow. The next day I got to ride two-handed on a narrow trail winding through a pine forest at the Catamount Outdoor Family Center in Williston, Vermont. There are 15 miles of trails for cross-country skiing and fat biking, and you can rent fat bikes at Catamount all winter. Dozens of Americans and Canadians are gathered around a campfire on International Fat Bike Day. Others try out new bikes, ride in groups, and race. This is just one in a series of events that comprise La Grande Fat Tour to promote fat biking in Vermont and Quebec. It is 14 degrees outside as bikers fortify themselves with hot chili and cold beer.
Just layer up. As long as your hands and your feet are warm, the rest of you will warm up.
Steve Fisher is a dentist who serves as president of the Fellowship of the Wheel, a local mountain biking group. Fisher's no-frills bike cost around $2,000. Adding to the sport's expense are insulated boots and pogies, down-filled handlebar covers to keep your hands warm. A studded fat bike tire costs more than many car tires. The tires on fat bikes are underinflated for maximum traction. Tires come as wide as 5 inches, double the width of a standard mountain bike tire. If you can't afford to shell out $2,000 for a fat bike, you can rent one. This is the second season that the Catamount Outdoor Center has offered fat bike rentals. Glenn Eames is the former owner of a Burlington bike shop called Old Spokes Home. He says that everybody who takes a fat bike for a test ride comes back with a huge smile on their face. Last winter, Eames got to ride on Lake Champlain.
We rode across the lake last year. The lake was frozen all the way to New York, so you can just go out there. It's like being on another planet, rolling over this frozen landscape. It's kind of like snowshoeing on a bicycle.
Many fat bikers are also cross-country skiers. Tina Santafonte, an environmental technician who works for the state of Vermont, started riding a fat bike 3 years ago.
I'm a skier in the winter. That's my main sport and passion. Fat biking kind of works out perfectly with skiing because when the skiing isn't great, the fat biking turns out to be pretty awesome and vice versa. So it's a great way to still get outside in the snow.
Before this year's skiing season started, there was a gathering of the Cross Country Skiing Association in Vermont, and fat biking was definitely on the agenda. That's because the ski industry has felt the economic effects of climate change. Michael Stearns is executive director of the Catamount Outdoor Center.
We opened the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving this year, but that was the first time we were able to do that in over 20 years. The winters are shifting where we're not getting a lot of snow in December and January, but for fat biking, you don't need a lot of snow. You know, there's maybe 2 inches on the ground right here, and everyone is having an amazing time.
At least two other Nordic ski facilities in Vermont have begun to allow fat biking on their trails. More than two dozen others in the Midwest and West have done so as well. But fat bikes can damage tracks set on trails for classic cross-country skiing. Catamount Trail Manager Mark Stannard says that when fat bikers ride trails with skiers and snowshoers, they need to observe trail etiquette.
One thing we try to encourage here at Catamount is bikers yield to all. If you're on a bike, you stop, you let the skier or the snowshoer pass by you. It's a safer approach. We have brakes. Skiers really don't. So it's just the right thing to do.
Fat biking competitions are springing up in the colder states. A 135-mile race is scheduled in Minnesota later this month. And on March 1st, the 350-mile Iditarod Trail Invitational follows the path of Alaska's famous sled dog race. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout, and our intern is Keely Flanagan. We had help this week from Tim Skog and from Latoya Dennis and John Strelecki at Milwaukee Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Bill Littlefield is in total seclusion at his seasonal retreat in the mountains of Japan to compose this year's Super Bowl haiku. But we'd like to hear yours as well. Submit your poems at onlyagame.org or by emailing us at oag@wbur.org. If we like your submission, it could end up on next week's show. Our final word this week comes from reporter and cyclist John Kalish, who, in a moment of hubris, tries taking that corner one more time on his fat bike. I guess he needs fatter tires. I'm Doug Trabue. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.